He has access to it, but those who have been purified. It is not an issue of those who purify themselves by wuzu and ghusl. It says, لا يمسه إلا المطهرون. You know, people, nobody will have access to it except those who have been purified. Purified by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's where you go to, إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمْ الرِّجْسَ وَيُطَهِّرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا. Comparing these two statements from the story of Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salam, where Asif Barakhiya is being, you know, described as مَنْ عِنْدَهُ عِلْمٌ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ, and this ayat from Surah Ra'ad, where the application is Ali there, مَنْ عِنْدَهُ عِلْمُ الْكِتَابِ, our sixth imam was asked about it. He said, how do you compare that ilm which was given to Asif Barakhiya to the ilm which was given to Ali in the light of these two ayats? Means the companion actually recited these two ayats. And there the Imam says that the knowledge which had been given to Asif Barakhiya was like a drop on the wing of a fly, and the knowledge given to Ali is the sea and the ocean.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. 19 years ago, a 23-year-old American activist, Rachel Corrie, was crushed to death by Zionist occupation forces. Today, we look back on her murder and ask, what are the lessons that the movement for the decolonization of Palestine can learn from Rachel's story? I'll be speaking to experts about this to find out more after this special report from Bianca Rahimi about Rachel Corrie's murder and the legacy she's left behind.
It is 19 years since Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old non-violent activist, was crushed to death, murdered by Zionist occupation forces using a Caterpillar bulldozer in Rafah, Gaza. But who was Rachel Corrie? Why was she in Rafah? And what has been her legacy?
I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children.
Rachel Corrie grew up in Olympia in Washington State in the U.S., famously concerned about the problems of the world. Later inspired by the anti-war movement after 9/11, Rachel was drawn to the issue of Palestine. She arrived in Gaza in 2003. She was murdered in Rafah, defending Palestinian homes from demolition, with her comrades from the International Solidarity Movement, a Palestinian-led activist group dedicated to non-violent, direct action against Zionist forces in the occupied West Bank.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying.
She gave a filmed interview 2 days before she was killed. 4 eyewitnesses contradicted Zionist military lies that Rachel's was an accidental death. Still, no one was brought to justice even after her parents brought legal action in the US and in Palestine. The last case ended in 2015 with the Supreme Court rejecting the claim for damages in the amount of $1. Rachel was murdered 3 days before the Western invasion of Iraq on the 19th of March 2003. Less than a month later, British ISM member Tom Herndl was shot in the head by a Zionist sniper while trying to protect Palestinian children from Zionist fire. Herndl's murder brought to the end a period of violent assaults on ISM members, which started in April 2002, resulting in 2 deaths and severe injuries for 3 other ISM members. None of the victims got full justice for the crimes committed against them. But Rachel's death galvanized resistance to ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Tributes flowed in from Palestine and around the world. She became an icon of resistance to Zionist ethnic cleansing. Her writings were turned into a play and published in full. The MV Rachel Corey was named in her honor and intended to join the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, but was delayed by mechanical problems possibly caused by sabotage. Eventually, it set sail for Gaza, where it was illegally boarded by Zionist forces in international waters in June 2010. Rachel's parents set up the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice and continue to campaign in support of BDS and Palestinian rights. But what has been the long-term impact? House demolitions have continued, indeed increased, since 2003, according to the United Nations. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions estimates that about 52,000 Palestinian homes were demolished in the Nakba and another 56,500 in the territories occupied since 1967. More than 1 million Palestinians have been made homeless as a result of the ongoing crimes against humanity. Today, Palestinians are even forced to demolish their own homes or suffer retribution from the military. But today, the resistance to home demolitions and ongoing ethnic cleansing is picking up pace. The Palestinian people resist the occupier daily, and worldwide revulsion against Zionist crimes continues to grow. We are closer now to the decolonization of Palestine than we have ever been since 2003, and Rachel's sacrifice is one of so many that have got us to this point.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. He's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined down the line today from Amsterdam by Evelien Lubbers. Evelien is an independent investigator and one of the founders of Spinwatch. She's also co-founded the Undercover Research Group, and this organisation examines corporate and state spying against activist movements. Her book on corporate state and spies is titled Secret Maneuvers in the Dark, Corporate and Police Spying on Activists. Welcome to the show. David, I wonder if I could start with you. I mean, that was an incredibly moving story about Rachel. I wonder how you would describe her legacy.
Well, she became an icon, didn't she, of resistance, of non-violent resistance against the Zionists. And that galvanised a lot of opposition. You know, as you saw with the naming of the MV Rachel Corey after her and the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, that was all part of the same kind of process of taking protest to the Zionist regime. But of course, the difficulty with it was that the Zionists didn't really care about nonviolent direct action. They were perfectly happy to kill and to seriously wound people who were fighting against them. So it's been a kind of it's a bittersweet legacy, isn't it? Because it did encourage a lot more activism, which has only grown since then. But at the same time, it does bring back the issue of what it is that can finally decolonize Palestine, which I think is not only non-violent direct action.
I mean, I wonder how you would describe, her impact on the campaign against Zionist settler colonialism.
Well, I think it's made it more visible. It's part of the reason it's become more visible. I mean, she was there before and was murdered before the BDS call was put out by Palestinian civil society. And in a way, the whole BDS movement is part of that same trajectory. And we see the BDS movement going now from strength to strength. Yes, it has some reversals and setbacks, but strength to strength and much more widely known, much more widely supported all around the world than it was back in the mid-2000s. So the legacy of the movement is the movement's much stronger, and that plays into a much greater sense, I think, in Palestine of the impending coming of actual liberation.
Yeah. I mean, Evelien, Rachel Corrie and Tom Herndl have a long tradition of non-violent direct action. I mean, what do you think are the lessons from these tactics?
I think it's a very good way of getting your message across. And I think they have, like, they have been an example of for many people. They are doing what many of us would want to do if we weren't, you know, confined to our jobs and our home. She really went there. And of course, it's very unfortunate that she has become such an example after her death. But I do think that it's very important to continue nonviolent action, of course, in combination with boycotts and maybe sometimes with violating the law from time to time.
Yeah. I mean, David, the you know, the demolitions are continuing, aren't they? Would you suggest that that means that the, you know, the Zionist state has got the upper hand?
It has the upper hand in the sense that it's still in power, as the figures there in the film showed. You know, that's more homes have been demolished since the territories were taken, since Gaza, the West Bank, and the Golan Heights were taken in 1967, than were destroyed in the Nakba itself. So this is an ongoing Nakba, which increases in intensity. And we saw last May the resistance against that in Sheikh Jarrah and in Silwan, and the way in which that has itself galvanized world public opinion. So yes, they have state power. They occupy, they are in control. But the control that they have is becoming more tenuous as more and more people see the weakness that there is against united resistance, which is now being demonstrated in Gaza, in the West Bank, and many other places.
I mean, we heard in the film, didn't we, about the fact that we're seeing some Palestinian families now being told to demolish their own homes. I mean, this is adding, obviously, insult to injury. I mean, can you say a bit more about that?
I mean, it's a particularly cruel punishment, isn't it? The people who are effectively refugees became refugees. And then in 67, when the occupation came, they were, some of them put out of their homes again, and there's an ongoing process of trying to, especially in East Jerusalem, Judaize East Jerusalem. And people are not just evicted from their homes by the fundamentally biased legal system, but they're then required to demolish their own homes within a very short period of time, a matter of hours, or they will be charged tens of thousands of shekels as restitution to the state. I mean, it's extraordinary that they are forced into doing this. Can you imagine having to demolish your own home within 2 days by your own hand, or you would be subject to fines of tens of thousands of pounds? It's just incredible that they would do that. But that's the way in which they operate. I mean, this is something which has only happened recently, and it shows the increasing depravity, essentially, of the Zionist regime.
And it gets, of course, little to no coverage on the mainstream media either, does it? Evelyn, I wonder if we could bring you back. And, I mean, you've got experience of activists challenging to the state and corporate power. I mean, what demands do you think that campaigners should be making in the current context, would you say?
Obviously that their houses are not being demolished, and instead the house of the Zionists would be demolished, but that is quite obvious. I think it's very important to keep on pressing and to make sure that this is known. As you said just now, this has not been reported on much, and it's such a terrible story. I think it's very important that they get it across in the mainstream media, because it's... Well, of course, it's difficult right now with the war going on in Europe now, and everybody, you know, the large audience for them, it's much nearer, and it's difficult to get into the mainstream media at present. But they should keep on trying and prevent. Yeah, it's difficult. You can imagine that they would want to take up arms, but then it would once again get into a state of full war again, and nobody wants that to happen, I guess.
Before the war in Ukraine, Evelyn, I mean, the mainstream media rarely, if ever, sort of cover these outrages in Israel, don't they? I mean, what should we be doing about that, do you think?
It's difficult. I think it has to do with how you promote your story, and maybe more use independent media and social media to get really good film footage across, because that's the way it works, and make sure that people in the West disseminate it here so that it gets the attention of journalists. That's currently the way it works, apparently.
Yes, I'm sure if more people were aware, there would be greater outrage. But if we could pause you there for now, we'll come back for a further discussion after this report on how undercover corporate and police agents spied on the campaign to seek justice for Rachel Corrie.
The bulldozer which crushed Rachel Corrie's fragile body was manufactured by the US company Caterpillar. The long-suffering parents of Rachel Corrie sought to bring charges against Caterpillar for their role in the killing of their 23-year-old daughter. However, Caterpillar had other plans and hired the private intelligence company C2I to infiltrate the campaign and spy on Rachel's parents as they struggled for justice. C2I was founded by former helicopter pilot in the British Special Forces, Justin King. His company illegally garnered information about the Corrie's legal strategy and also posed as sympathizers in order to infiltrate the campaign. While Rachel's parents traveled to the Caterpillar offices and asked to meet the chairman, the company refused and was paying C2I to spy on the middle-aged bereaved couple. Rachel's parents even purchased shares in the company so they could have a chance of talking to the board of directors. At the same time C2I was infiltrating the Rachel Corrie campaign, it was being treated as an authority on counter-espionage by the BBC. Justin King solemnly advised the BBC that spies are very easy to find. Sadly, it isn't hard, he said. I'm told the going rate to get a cleaner to steal something for you in London is £20, said Mr. King. Simultaneous to the surveillance of the Rachel Corrie campaign, there was a long-term infiltration of her organisation, the International Solidarity Movement, by the British state in the shape of a spy cop with a fake name, Rob Harrison. Described as the perfect wallflower, Harrison insinuated himself into the ISM and was noted for always offering to drive people places in his car and rarely stating a political opinion. The undercover officer deceived the woman involved in the political campaign into a sexual relationship. It has been said that the undercover officers were permitted or encouraged to form sexual relationships with campaigners they were spying on to obtain information. What is clear is that while much of the world was horrified at the killing of Rachel Corrie and rightly demanded accountability, the British state and Caterpillar went to great lengths to protect the killers.
Evelyn, you've done some groundbreaking research, haven't you, on corporate spying. I wonder if you could tell us how a corporation like Caterpillar would go about infiltrating pro-Palestinian groups.
I think you could say in these days there's two ways of doing it. It's one, in real life, so to say, pretending to be an activist, go to a demonstration or a public event, show interest and hope you get invited to meetings. On the other hand, on the second thing is that, of course, today with online groups and online communication, it's in a way much easier to get yourself on a mailing list of supporters of Corrie, for instance, get yourself into groups that have meetings online and pretend to be an activist, like C2I did in the case of Rachel Corrie's parents.
I mean, I wonder whether you could say a little bit about what sort of information C2I would have gathered about the Rachel Corrie campaign.
Companies and the police in general want to know what is going to happen next. In this case, C2I wanted to know about the campaign against Caterpillar. The company wanted to know what they were up to and what was going to happen so they could prepare themselves and take away the element of surprise if the campaign would sit on their doorstep all at a sudden, for instance. On the other hand, they would want to know who was involved. Names, addresses, background of people, where they live, in this case, they found out about the online support group and the online meetings the parents of Rachel Corey were having, and managed to get into it.
I wonder, David, what your take on it?
Yeah, it's a means to try and subvert and undermine activist challenges against the corporation. So the parents there, Rachel Corey's parents, you know, went through the normal way of buying the shares to try and get into the meetings to confront the company. Of course, the company wasn't at all interested in that. It was interested in subverting the campaign against them by finding out intelligence, as Eveline has been saying, but also by what the companies do in this circumstance. They try and destabilize the organization. They put out false information, they leak various things to try and stop the organization having a political effect and to attain its goal. So, yeah, it's a means to try and sabotage democratic pressures on the corporation to deal with the wrongs that they've done.
Mm. Eveline, I wonder if I could just ask you, I mean, is there any overlap between these infiltration and spying activities between the corporate sector and governments?
Yes, indeed, there is. The people that are spied on by the police secret units are usually campaign groups that aim for change, that fight for change, fight against corporations and state corruption. So undermining their campaigns is working for the agenda of the large corporations. Second factor is that the private intelligence companies like C2I often have former police officers specialized in this kind of undermining work on their boards. C2I had at least two former officers who were retired from the police at a relatively young age and then moved on to work for private corporate intelligence companies. So they brought all their knowledge and all their network. They probably have a good access to their former colleagues to get information on the people they're spying on. So it's both in personnel, in network, and in agenda.
Right. I mean, David, I mean, what, you know, when Caterpillar's nefarious activities were exposed, I mean, how did they react to that?
Well, what that happened in 2017, there was a leak of a cache of documents on C2I and a number of other intelligence operations. And they responded by saying nothing at all. They don't respond to those kinds of allegations. And, of course, we get nothing. So what you see is them just stonewalling, and that's a typical public relations technique. And you've got, essentially, the police and the corporate spy companies, as Eveline says, working together. I mean, the famous case in London of London Greenpeace, the small organisation which used to meet in a bookstore just near King's Cross Station, where McDonald's, who was suing them for libel, had two different sets of spies in the small meetings each time, and also there at the same time was a special branch operative. So the meetings were more or less sort of half made up of spies. Now, that kind of thing indicates that the possibility of not just of the interests that the police are defending being corporate interests, but that they're actually collaborating. These spying operations are actually collaborating. And it's deeply concerning that that would be the case. And we don't have nearly enough information and accountability about that. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the UK is that there's an ongoing public inquiry of the spy cops situation. You know, these undercover police officers didn't just spy on the Palestine Solidarity Movement, but across a whole range, thousands of groups and left-wing groups in this country over the last half century, as Eveline has been saying. And we're getting a little bit of information from that. Evelyn, in particular, has been doing some stunning work on that. But it's really very minor compared to what we really need, which would be to stop this kind of activity altogether.
I mean, Evelyn, we've heard some shocking revelations, haven't we, about intimate relations being formed between undercover agents and activists. I mean, would you say in your experience that these sort of intimate relationships are actively encouraged by the people who are controlling these agents?
I'd rather say the women were deceived into relationships, which is closer to the truth. Or at the official undercover policing inquiry, which is being held now, the officers all claim that they were not told not to do it, and it just happened. If they agree that it happened, they said there weren't any rules. On the other hand, if we compare the experience of the women, there is a pattern. There is it always the undercover officers always know the women very well. They kind of mirror what they say. They know about their tastes, about their habits, and if they eventually have to leave, they all face some psychological crisis or some. There's very, very similar stories in their living. So that sort of seems to be part of a plan doing that. And they're usually using these women to improve their status within a group. You know, if there would be any suspicions, if you have a relationship with someone within the group or in the just outside the group,
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm sorry to say, Evelyn, we're absolutely out of time. But I want to thank you and David for your thoughts today. Very illuminating and interesting. Thank you, everyone. As I say, we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. Nowruz, symbol of peace and friendship. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz is the time of refreshment of the nature. Flowers and trees blossom and grasses sprout out of the earth. Ices melt and rush toward plains in streams and rivers. All these inspire happiness and they are the blessings of God for mankind. Human beings from all enjoy these blessings and beauties. This is the thought that is absolutely against the monopoly and excessiveness. It is based on freedom and equality of men. And Nowruz has been conveying this message for millennia. Nowruz reminds human beings that darkness, cold, and evils should be put behind, and we should think of a bright, green, and beautiful future. The nature is a very good teacher if we hear its message. Every year, Nowruz repeats its lessons in the form of traditions and customs. One of these customs is the setting of half-seen tablecloth. Iranians have set this special tablecloth a few hours before the turn of the year for centuries. This tablecloth includes mainly seven items, beginning with the Farsi letter of Sin, S in English. These items include sabze, or green sprouts of wheat, peas, or lentils, symbolizing freshness, revival, and rebirth. It shows the rebirth of the nature and putting behind the cold winter. Sabze is often put with sombol or hyacinth to remind us that there is death and darkness. Sabze also teaches us that we should forget darkness and evil and stick to joy and generosity like the nature. The second item on half-seen tablecloth is sib, or apple, symbolizing sweetness, beauty, and life. It also symbolizes health. Iranians put apple in the tablecloth to wish health and better life for all. This is a good aspiration for all, especially in the tough conditions that the unholy coronavirus has imposed on the life of nearly 8 billion people on planet Earth. Samanu, or fresh wheat shoots pudding, is another ingredient of half-seen tablecloth. It also symbolizes health and amplitude. It indicates wishing a blessed year and healthy food for all. For centuries, and especially recent decades, powerful governments have prevented the access of poor nations to healthy and adequate food. They have accumulated millions of tons of food while there are hundreds of millions of hungry people in various parts of the world. Seer, or garlic, symbolizing health and disinfection, is another item on half-seen tablecloth. Another item on half-seen tablecloth is sirke, or vinegar, as the symbol of patience. Garlic and vinegar can also symbolize cleanness and disinfection. These two items symbolize removal of all evils and pollutions. They remind us that we should start the new year with warding off enmities and grudges. They teach us to refresh our hearts and souls like the nature. Somag, or sumac, is the next item on half-seen tablecloth. It symbolizes life and vividness. The last item on this tablecloth is senjed. Senjed, or oleaster fruit, symbolizes love and rationality. These two items, sumac and oleaster fruit, also symbolize love and altruism. Ancient Iranians believed that the blossoms of oleaster increase love and bring the hearts together like the seeds of sumac. These were the seven items on half-seen tablecloth, which begin with the Farsi letter Sin, S in English. However, it is also believed that seke, or coin, is another item on half-seen tablecloth. Coins are put on half-seen tablecloth to show wealth and richness. A brief look at Nowruz traditions reveals that they can bolster social relations and enhance friendship among human beings. Nowruz customs can act as role models for governments to give up selfishness and think on closer ties and sustainable peace. Nowruz traditions teach us to abandon excessive demands and supremacy over other fellow men. They stress altruism and generosity. Nowruz is rich in the culture of love and justice for all. It reprimands usurpation of the rights and properties of others. These are the cultural roots that have supported Nowruz for 3 millennia. That's why Islam approves of many Nowruz customs and traditions. Nowruz is a good opportunity to ponder upon our deeds and repent for evil deeds and thoughts. The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says that any day on which we do not commit sin is Nowruz, meaning new day. The greatest sin is injustice, and Nowruz conveys the message of justice for all. Iranians always put a copy of the Noble Quran on half-seen tablecloth to indicate that they follow the teachings of the Quran alongside national feast. Well, dear listeners, in this new year, we appeal to God to refresh our hearts like the nature. Amen.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker, we were talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And I'm going to ask you about what we left off, in fact, Sheikh Tawid, in the last episode about the invalidating agents for the prayer. To my recollection, you have enumerated five of those invalidating agents. Would you please continue to the sixth and to the last one, please?
As you rightly mentioned, we're talking about those things which make a prayer void. And of course, the sixth thing which invalidates prayers is to talk even by uttering, for example, a single word consisting of one or single letter which has a meaning or denotes something. For example, I think, as far as I remember, we have discussed this in one of the previous episodes, but we are now discussing the invalidating agents in more detail, of course. So we cannot utter a single unrelated word in prayer, even if it has a meaning, something good, something positive. It doesn't become a license for us to say it in prayer, okay? Yes. And we, of course, let me just say it very clearly, that we have no right whatsoever to add anything to the prayer what is not a part of the prayer. So, for example, to recite a zikr or to include a dua, for example, to recite a zikr which is highly recommended to read out of the prayer, we cannot add to the prayer what is not a part of the prayer. And the prayer has fixed, you know, zikr. That zikr that has been prescribed by the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, the Holy Prophet said to us, "Sallu kama ra'aytumuni usalli," okay?
Right.
Offer your prayers in the same way as I offer, okay? Do not add to the prayer anything which is not part of the prayer. Otherwise, it's called bid'ah. So we cannot, you know, include something which is alien to the prayer and which is not related to the prayer.
Like folding the arms, for example.
Now, for example, folding the arms, of course, talking and like saying a single word, like, for example, qay. I think qay means to protect yourself.
Yes.
So if we just utter this word deliberately and intentionally, the prayer becomes void. But of course, if we just say something unforgetfully or, you know, erroneously or unintentionally, the prayer is not made void because we did not intend in the first place to say it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Would you please talk about the seventh?
Yeah, the seventh, of course. The seventh thing which makes the prayer void is to laugh loudly, to, you know, intentional loud laugh.
If someone, or laughter.
Yeah, yeah. And if the laugh or the guffawing is uncontrollable or involuntary. And of course, if what prompted it in the first place was intentional, it makes the prayer void. The prayer is definitely affected. But okay, if one laughs loudly or unintentionally, or if he, you know, laughs without, you know, without emitting any voice, you know, there is no problem. Sometimes you might laugh and you might start giggling, but there is no voice, okay? No voice is heard. That, because it does not produce any sound, you are laughing in your heart somehow.
Yeah. Yes.
So that will not affect your prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the eighth invalidating agent. As you know, if one intentionally weeps, you know, silently or loudly over something worldly, something, let's say, mundane, you know, his prayer becomes void. You know, but if a person weeps silently or loudly due to the fear of Allah or for the hereafter, because of, you know, a divine or a heavenly matter, there's no harm, because we do see that some scholars, some great scholars, you know, I have myself seen many scholars who weep in their prayers, and it's quite audible, you know, they weep in their prayers. It's not because of worldly reasons or because of earthly or mundane reasons. They weep during prayer because of fear of Allah. And
yes,
because of extreme taqwa, they have reached a level of taqwa where when they offer their prayers, they find themselves guilty, and they think that they have not observed, they have not offered their prayers in the way which Allah deserves, and they did not worship Allah in the way He deserves. Of course, we can never worship Allah in a deserving manner. So that's why many scholars weep. And that kind of weeping does not affect the prayer.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back again and continue our program of Islamic laws on IRIB English Radio related to prayers according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Don't go away. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker in the studio. We are talking about the laws related to prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And more specifically, Sheikh Javid, you were talking about the invalidating agents and you have reached eighth.
Yeah, I think I have reached the ninth one.
Yes.
The ninth one.
Okay.
The ninth invalidating agent is when a person offers his prayer, and he does, while offering prayer, actions like clapping or jumping up and down, you know, because it's necessary for a person offering prayers to keep his body steady, motionless, and of course, he cannot do anything which deforms or which actually takes the prayer out of the recognized mode, you know. For example, if a person starts clapping or jumping, this will definitely invalidate his prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not make any difference whether he does it intentionally or forgetfully, because he goes out of the form of prayer. The form of prayer is not maintained, you know. But, you know, there is no problem in actions which do not change the form of prayer. Like, for example, making a brief sign with one's hand, like pointing to something. To, for example, if you are offering prayer and you just point to someone, to a family member, okay, to turn on the light, or let's say to turn off this stove, okay?
Right.
It doesn't make the prayer void, okay? It's a small action that does not change the form of the prayer. And of course, the tenth invalidating agent is eating and drinking. We do know that no one can eat and drink while offering prayer. And if a person offering prayer eats or drinks in such a manner that people would not say that he was actually offering prayer or that he was in the state of prayer, his prayer would definitely become void, regardless of whether he does it intentionally or unintentionally. Eating and drinking under any circumstances will definitely cause the prayer to become void.
Sheikh Javed, when you say eating, you know, sometimes it happens to people that, you know, even after brushing their teeth, some particles of the food still remain in their mouth.
Sure.
So if you're in a state of the prayer and then you feel there is a particle in your, for example, mouth, can you still swallow it?
You're right.
Would that be considered as eating?
You know, in common view, that's not considered to be eating. You know, no one is going to tell you. Because I did mention that if someone is calling, someone considers you as being busy eating something or drinking something,
right,
then it makes the prayer void. Okay, if you have a small particle of food or food particle in your mouth and you swallow it, it does not affect your prayer.
I see.
There are two more invalidating agents left.
Yes,
I would like to,
you know,
squeeze in these two,
I appreciate it.
Invalidating agents. And of course, any doubt concerning the number of rakas in the prayer, which consists of, for example, two rakas or three rakas, I think we discussed to some extent, we elaborated on the issue of doubts and said that if a person doubts between one or two rakat while he's offering two rakat prayer, or while he is offering a three rakat prayer like the Maghrib prayer, and he doubts whether he offered two rakat or three rakat of prayer, or one rakat or two rakat, then, of course, his prayer becomes void. And, of course, if a person, adds an extra rukun, for example, he performs one more ruku, one more ruku, or he performs two more sajdas in the prayer, which are considered to be rukun of the prayer. Adding one rukun or deleting or omitting one rukun from the prayer will definitely make the prayer void. And this is, of course, the 12th invalidating agent. So the 11th was to make a doubt, which makes the prayer void. And, of course, the discussion concerning the doubts is lengthy.
Yes.
And then adding or omitting a rukun from the prayer, which definitely makes the prayer void.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, for your nice elaboration of the invalidating agents for the prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.